This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Check out my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and let me hear from you. I would love to know what books have made a difference in your life and what authors you would like me to invite on Joy on Paper. So just check it out. It's Facebook Radio Joy on Paper. Now, I am so happy to welcome back to the program a real friend of Joy on Paper, who he has done our Book Buzz segments for the past 9 months or so, and I am so proud of him. Robert K. Tenenbaum is a fantastic author of 32 books. Three of them are nonfiction, and of course, 29 are part of his wonderful series, Robert Butch Karp and Marlene Champy series. And I'm so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Robert K. Tenenbaum.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back with you.
Hi, Bob. Well, you know, Bob, you are always, your books are always so heart-pounding. You know, they get us the suspense, the excitement. But in this case, it really, at one point, it was heart-stopping. That was a big impact, I can tell you. It's a very exciting opening to the book.
Well, thank you very much. You know, we're dealing here with subject matter that's so important with respect to attempting to search for truth, but the competing forces of a complicit media with ideologues and demagogues sort of changed the whole equation now. But you need to be steadfast still in making sure, particularly if you're in the criminal justice system in any way, and most assuredly if you're a prosecutor, you can't jump to conclusions in order to satisfy your local media who pick winners and losers right off the bat. They're not interested in searching for truth. And,
well, let's explain a little to the listeners about the new book. It's the 29th book in this series, and it's called Without Fear or Favor. And it's an appropriate title in many ways because you have gone into this without fear of the criticism or the pushback that you might have from the media on really tackling a very sensitive subject.
Well, it deals with the right now the war on police, and interesting to note that my very first book, Badge of the Assassin, was about the investigation and the trials, the prosecutions that I was responsible for as an assistant district attorney in the Homicide Bureau in New York County District Attorney's Office when legendary D.A. Frank Hogan was running the justice system. And back then, there are people who were self-proclaimed members of a black liberation army who were going around the country executing police. That is, they fell in stepping back at police officers, and without any interaction, they just pulled out their weapons and shot them in the back. And they did that in New York, and the investigation spanned, and the investigation and trial spanned over 4 years, and finally I was able to prosecute the cases in court, and they were convicted. The killers were convicted in the case. And similarly, what's going on today is the notion that whenever we have a situation that looks colorable, if you will, with respect to a police officer, and regardless of whether the police officer is involved, is himself a minority individual, the media, demagogues, the whole Black Lives Matter groups get involved with the case right away and demand the blood of the officer who wielded the weapon instead of waiting to see what the investigation is all about. So it's not just a question of everybody who is involved on one side is all good and the other side is all bad. There are nuances and colorations to this. But there is one thing that remains inviolate. Those are our values, and our values talk about we don't deprive anybody of liberty or freedom because that's what we're about, unless we have proof beyond any and all doubt, and we go to court with it. And that's really what this story is all about. It's really about it's a reaffirmation of our values.
Well, you know, the badge of the assassins, that goes all the way back, I think, what, to 1979, something like
exactly.
that? Yeah, exactly. And of course, at that time, as you said, the situation was very dire. And then we seem to have had a period of time where, well, certainly things changed in New York, where the crime went down and people, I think, appreciated the police. And then everything sort of has just gone completely the opposite way now. And your book, you know, in this new book, you really have talked both about the press. You have one character who I think represents actually quite a few people in the press. And of course, the instigators behind this trying to rile up the public and rile up the people against the police.
And that's exactly what happened back in the late 60s and 70s. The notion was in Badge of the Assassin, for example, and the Badge of the Assassin was that the killers, the assassins, actually took the police officers' weapons as if to dehumanize them and show their friends, look what I did, look, I have his weapon kind of mentality, if you can call it a mentality. But now we're confronted with a situation where everyday policing has become very dangerous. It's very changed. Any legitimate stop that a police officer makes can turn into a deadly homicidal murderous ambush. And that has changed the equation on how police have to be on the ready at all times. After all, we just had a young woman who's a police officer with young children sitting in a car and was blown away by a madman. Person indicated who was a shooter, didn't like police and all that kind of nonsense, and took this precious life. Well, so,
you know, the wonderful thing about your books is that when you pick up one of your books, and for anyone who's read them, it's like stepping into sort of a family. You know your characters, and of course you write so it's really refreshing. Your writing is still, you know, if you look at the first book to now the 29th book, there's still a freshness about it. And your main character, of course, is Robert Butch Karp, who is a legendary DA here in your books, and of course you're legendary for all of the work that you did in the New York County District Attorney's office. I know that you never lost a felony trial case, and you put away so many violent criminals, and of course your character Robert Butch Karp is like a shadow figure to you, I think, and as I said, the stories are so fresh. You have his family. We really know his family. We know his wife, of course, Marlene Champy, his kids. So it's always so wonderful to get into your books.
Well, thank you, because I'm fortunate. I only went to law school to work in the office of District Attorney Frank Hogan. He was totally apolitical. He was a lifelong Democrat, but he always had Liberal Party support, which is the party of David Dubinsky and the International Lady Garment Workers. That John Lindsay, who was a Republican, ran as a liberal for mayor of the city of New York and was elected. And then Hogan was also endorsed by the Republican Party and the Conservative Party. So it was an apolitical operation. That's the only way to run the justice system. There's no Republican, there's no Democrat way to investigate a case, certainly, and there's certainly no liberal or conservative way to evaluate evidence. And I tried over 200 cases to verdict when I was in the DA's office, at least. When I was in the criminal courts, we used to have about 150 cases a day, basically, anywhere from 100 to 150 cases a day. There were 250 new cases coming into the DA's office every day. And you had to go through that calendar. You finished it by noon, and in the afternoon, you were trying cases right there, standing up, bango. But that wasn't until I went into the Homicide Bureau for years and years, then the kind of preparation with experts and with great detectives, terrific police officers, from whom you learn a great deal. And I will tell you this about the police I ran into. I would say over 99.9% of them were committed to serving the community just as we want, just as everyone would want, to have someone who was there to protect them, someone you can speak to about suspicious characters wandering around. That is what has immeasurably aided me, and it's something that I fall back on all the time with respect to the issue that you raised, thank you very much, about authenticity and being vibrant about it and current. And that's why Without Fear or Favor is, to me, you know, as I say, it's my best novel, but my wife reminds me, I say that about every novel. But it's like our children, you know, we love them all. And that each time with writing, though, I think we can get hone it down and hone it down and get sharper and sharper all the time. So I think that Without Fear or Favor is very important, because I remember Simon & Schuster, someone said, well, what does that mean, kind of thing. I said, look, I didn't make it up. In every trial, the court, the judge, will say to the jury, the fact finders, that you, the jurors, will determine the facts in this case based upon the evidence that's been presented and the exhibits that I, as the court, mark into evidence. And you will find the facts without fear or favor to either side, either party. And that is standing hornbook law that every judge says basically in every trial. So in order to keep the justice system where we want it to be, which is high integrity, honest, search for truth, and then have determinations made, it has to be done without fear or favor to either party. And we don't see that very much today, regrettably. Every day we realize that we're in a two-tiered, at least two-tiered, system of justice. And it's very, it's debilitating, because each generation of Americans has to understand that there is one tier, and that is the search for truth tier. That is apolitical, and it's done from a very careful case analysis of what the facts are. And if you don't have a case, you don't simply, you know, indict because maybe you think the defendant will somehow dispose of the case by way of plea. That's like the worst of law enforcement. What you want to do is you further investigate cases. You FI those cases where you believe you have factual guilt, but you don't have legally admissible evidence to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's what I'm trying to say, is that we need to upgrade, not get involved, as Patrick Moynihan, Senator Moynihan from New York, said many years ago. We're defining deviance downward, and that's not what we do in America. We have to constantly strive for the ideal, and that's why we need apolitical, experienced people in the justice system, particularly in law enforcement, dealing with these cases. It's not personal. You don't say, I'm going after this guy, kind of thing. What you're doing is, what is the crime? What are the facts? How do we prove it? And it's really proof beyond any and all doubt. This whole thing, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, is a legal standard, of course, in the criminal case. But you don't ever want to have a jury having some doubts and have them say, well, it's not a reasonable doubt. If there are any doubts in the case, that's what you call a hung jury and possibly acquittal territory. You have to prepare this case, and you have to have the facts that produce evidence beyond any and all doubt. And that's how it works, and that's how it should work. Because if we would define what it means to be an American, it means just, you know, a country conceived in liberty. That was what's so unique about our revolution. The revolution wasn't one government passed to another government. The whole notion was that it's not government that grants us our rights. It's from the hand of God that gives us our inalienable rights, as they were written in the Declaration of Independence. And the Constitution is the political structure, the legal political structure that gives those rights meaning to every American. So if you're in the justice system, you're going to wind up depriving people of their liberty and freedom, then you better be sure that it's a case that is beyond any and all doubt.
Well, you know, I think that your books, well, one thing, of course, this book is timely. So many of your books, you know, are just right on time at when we're talking about a subject, sort of like Fatal Conceit. Wow, that came out, I think, at just the right time. And that was a great book. In that case, you had, of course, the general who was assassinated. And, you know, this book, of course, we talk sort of torn out of the headlines. And this is a subject that people are interested in. And I think they will find a lot of depth in your discussion here. As always, of course, we have, in the beginning of your book, we have the crime. And then we get to the second part where we have the trial. And nobody is better at writing a trial than you are. You just, I mean, you've lived it so much. And I always love the trial segments of your books.
Well, thank you very much. Again, it's, you know, it's only because I was trained by probably three of the greatest who ever served in the Hogan office, in the Manhattan DA's office. And that was John Keenan, who right now is the federal district court judge in Manhattan, Mel Glass, who was a criminal court judge, and Bob Lehner, who was in the Homicide Bureau when I was a young assistant DA. That was, I graduated into the Homicide Bureau after serving for a couple of years in the lower bureaus. The training bureaus, but they were very important because you were active every day. And that's what I mean, how fortunate I was. I'm the luckiest person, I could say, in my judgment, who ever served in that office because of the mentors that I had. And they were really the best. So there's an art form to this whole business, just like there is in everything else, just like in talk radio in theater, whatever it may be, there is truly an art form to it. And I was introduced to that, and they guided me through this so that we can discuss, in the books that I'm doing, we can discuss how the administration of justice ought to work as conceived by the founders. And after all, we look back at the founders. We had John Adams represented the British soldiers at what was so-called Boston Massacre in 1770 and at Haymarket Square. So, you know, it wasn't a popular thing to do. Certainly, Adam's cousin did not want him to get involved in defending the British soldiers, notwithstanding the fact that he had, about 6-7 of them acquitted after trial. He represented the leader, the captain of the group when shots were fired at the colonists in Boston and so on. So we had Hamilton, who represented Tories after the war. He didn't want them to be discriminated against. As a matter of fact, the very famous case of Rutgers v. Waddington, which was like in 1784, Hamilton, Rutgers was a woman who owned a brewery, and she had to surrender it to the British because when they occupied New York, they took over the businesses that existed at the time, and they put Waddington in as a proprietor. He made improvements, and after the war, after the Revolution, Rutgers brought her case, and she was, and Waddington was represented by Hamilton, and Rutgers was a very famous patriot. She, you know, she was a very sympathetic plaintiff as well in the case, and he argued, interestingly, in 1784, Hamilton, about the notion of judicial review, that certain laws were illegal that were passed given the nature of existing laws. So he laid the groundwork for Marbury v. Madison, the famous case, of course, gave the judiciary its rightful place as the third tripartite form of government that we have. We have the executive, of course, and the Congress and the judiciary, all which is defined in the Constitution. So we were fortunate to have great founders who had a great sense of justice. And I was fortunate to have a trio who really walked me through this whole business. And I try to reflect that in the books. And that's why I say I have a great advantage with respect to talking about these cases, because I have been through it. I've lived it. And I was in the courtrooms doing it. I was up in precincts, police precincts, in the wee hours of the morning investigating. When I was in the Homicide Bureau, we were on call every 7 to 10 days if you weren't prosecuting a case in court. And you got called from anywhere between 8 in the morning on a Friday to 8 in the morning on Saturday. But I never got a call before midnight on any of those times I was on. I would get called at 1 in the morning, and a squad car would pick me up at our apartment, and I'd go off into the precinct where the case had jurisdiction in that precinct, and talk to the detectives if the defendant was willing to speak, have a stenographer there, advise him of his rights, and go through the whole process. And then before speaking to the defendant, speaking to all the witnesses and the lay witnesses and the experts who may have been there from ballistics or otherwise.
Well, that's why I think Butch Karp is so popular, because it is realistic. I mean, you know your stuff there. And the wonderful thing about all of your books are you have recurring characters, of course, beside the family. You have other characters sort of that weave in and out, and that's why they make us feel very comfortable when we're reading your books. In you know, there's Dirty Warren and Walking Booger and David Grail and some other characters, and of course all of the people around Butch and his family. It's just a factor when you're writing, when you're a writer, and you are such a good writer, you can really tell a story, that you have these characters that you've woven into the over the years, and so that we really know them and look forward to seeing them. As a matter of fact, sometimes in a book we'll say, oh, why don't we have enough of the twins, Zach and Giancarlo? Why don't we have Lucy? You know, we want more sometimes. But in this book, of course, we have the new characters that you introduce, reporter's name? The reporter, Pete.
Pete Van Sant.
Whoa, he's like an amalgamation, I think, of some really bad reporters we have out there. And you've done a beautiful job with them.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's very important to deal with this in a very real-world sense. And one of the fascinating characters that I have a great affinity for are characters who have sort of hit rock bottom in life, and since we are a redemptive people, in my judgment, we are a moral people, and we're very redemptive. We believe in that second chance, and we have here a policewoman who has fallen from grace, who becomes a very important person in this story, and the degree of bearing one's soul in the courtroom is something that I have lived through with many witnesses. And believe it or not, there are some who write me to this day where, in cases where they testified for the people, for the prosecution, and over 40 years ago, they're writing me asking for certain advice and other kinds of issues. And it's amazing to me that this goes on the way it does, and without fear or favor. There is such a character, and she is a former policewoman, and has a very important tale to tell. So, it's the notion of what our values are and who we are and what really distinguishes us as a people.
Runs through all your books, the respect for the value system that has made our country great.
That's right, and I wanted to say that when I was talking about the uniqueness of the American Revolution, unlike any other, is that, you know, we receive our precious rights from the hand of God. We don't receive them from legislatures or parliaments or legislative acts. Those parliaments, those legislatures, the Congress in America, for example, is forewarned that any intervention, any reordering of America is going to be met by a very, very strong challenge from the American people, notwithstanding whether they are so-called deplorables or otherwise, as they were outrageously described in the last election. But these are real true blue Americans who aren't seeking publicity, who go about doing their job every day and raising their family and trying to, in some fashion, have it, you know, a lot better for their children than they had it. And they're not going to sit idly by and witness and permit the slow undoing of that value system that has made this country great. And we're living through that right now, in my judgment.
Oh, that's for sure. Sometimes it's overwhelming.
It is. But we have to remember that the nature of America has always been a struggle with respect to this. After all, John Adams, during the American Revolution, said, one-third of the population was Tory, one-third was timid, and one-third was true blue. And that was during the American Revolution. My God, so if anything, we're making improvements. People say it's 50-50. Well, I say it's much greater than 50-50 with respect to people who understand the values and reflect it in their lives. So, the map of America is truly red. There are blue spots, certainly, in major metropolitan areas, but the real issue to me is, it's not the red and the blue, it's a question of problem solving. And if we can get our heads together on that, then you're going to see real reform, real progress made, particularly in schools, in the public schools. I went to the public schools in New York City, and they were, you know, top quality. Now, most of these public schools in New York City are failing, and they're dangerous. They're not safe. And that's something that you have to take your hat off to people who are in the charter school movement, which are public schools, and who are teaching children in the inner cities, and they're succeeding. And that's what we call the low-hanging fruit, as they say, with respect to reform. But it's not being done the way it should be because of people who are strictly out to obtain power and are beholden to various interest groups. And that's always been a concern about from the founders right through to Tocqueville and those who have written about American democracy. And that's something that we have to, you know, push back on.
Well, and sort of that unbridled ambition that hits politicians and hits leaders of some groups, that they don't care about anything but just getting that power and not thinking about the overall picture of what is good for the people.
That's exactly right. And that's the battle line right there. You know, just recently I get a kick out of, to bring it really current, I get a kick out of the statement made by the majority leader in the Senate who said that the president, you know, hadn't been around here. He doesn't understand how long something takes to get done, as if that's the way it ought to be. So it's interesting that we're confronted with these realities, but the American people understand it. And in my judgment, that's one of the major reasons they elected the president, was because they didn't want to wait around and wait around. They wanted people to be held to their word. And that's why I enjoy doing the books. I thrive on doing the books because Without Fear or Favor, for example, represents a very important statement with respect to how we treat people in law enforcement. And again, not everybody in law enforcement is walking around lily white, if you will. There are different cultures, there are different groups within law enforcement, all of which have to be very much overseen with a critical eye, because the search for truth is not just some game that's played out there. It's very, very serious, and it defines how effective the justice system is, but it also defines us, because the more effective the justice system is, the more we can sit back and say, we have done in dealing with the most heinous criminals the way things ought to have been done, in order to search for the truth and let the jurors know and the courts know, and the people in the community know what the real reasons were that one would convict in these cases. What would you do in a high-profile case, knowing that everybody is watching, knowing basically, even though jurors are not supposed to, perhaps they find out. Hopefully they find out after the verdict they render. But they find out that everything is being covered. So how in the world would you vote to convict unless you can explain to your family members, your co-workers, your colleagues, your relatives, whomever, why it was you voted guilty? Because the evidence was so overwhelming, and it's not because the DA said so, it's because of the nature of how we learned why the police, out of everyone in the universe, focused on the killer.
Well, you know,
once
I think
you're able to do that, particularly as a prosecutor, then you've done your job.
And I think in this, you know, I think in this book, Without Fear or Favor, people will see it. People will really learn. As with all of your books, there's a lot to be learned from your experience and from all of the ideas that you bring into your books. And you know, after I finish talking to you, I'm going to be talking to Linda Fairstein.
Oh, my blessed friend. She is darling and dear, and I love Linda deeply, and I hope everybody buys Linda's books. She's a very special person.
Well, the wonderful thing is, of course, her new book, Deadfall, is, you know, a timely book. It's a book about the whole trade of animals and And big game hunting and all of the abuse that is involved in that. And so her book is very timely. Your book is very timely. And it's funny that you both, you know, two good friends come out with a book the same time.
Well, I'm a big fan of Linda. She's a fabulous person. She was a great lawyer. She's a wonderful person, a very special person, a very courageous person. And we were in the DA's office during the same period of time. She came in, I would believe, around 4 or 5 years after I was already there. And I knew from, you know, speaking with her and observing her in court and the manner in which she conducted herself, that she would be a great, great assistant district attorney, because she represents and has been imbued with the kind of values that we're talking about. And she also happens to be extremely intelligent and very bright. So she's a great mix of it all, and she's a very, very dear person. So please tell her I love her dearly, and I hope her book is number one.
Okay, right there with yours. Because I want to thank you again, everybody. The book is called Without Fear or Favor, Robert K. Tannenbaum. It's available on August 15th, everywhere that books are sold. And Bob, thank you so much for joining me today. And as I've told people, this is a standalone book, but if they really want to have fun, start at the beginning, because you will love this series. Robert Butch Karp and his wife Marlene Champy and all the family are really fascinating.
Well, Patsy, thank you so much. It's great to have the opportunity to chat with you, and hopefully people will read will read Without Fear or Favor. As you say, it's totally all the novels are separate and independent and apart. But today more so than ever before, we need to have an understanding of how the justice system ought to work and why we have to be patient with respect to letting the investigation flow when you have people who are serious, who are experienced, who are well-trained, and they will search for truth and find it, hopefully. And then the courtroom proceedings will result and reflect it. So thank you very much.
Okay. Arthur. Thank you, Bob. Bye-bye now.
God bless, Bob.
Okay, we're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be back with Linda Fairstein. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose.
Mike is offering 50% off his 4-pack special.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-871-1543 and use the promo code PATSY, and Mike will offer you free shipping. Once again, that's 800-871-1543, promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper today, Linda Fairstein, who is going to be talking about the 19th book in her wonderful, absolutely fantastic series that features prosecutor Alexandra Coop Cooper. And the new book is called Deadfall. Hi, Linda.
Patsy, you're so great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's so nice. I don't know if you know that since I spoke to you last, an old friend of yours, Bob Tannenbaum, has joined Joy on Paper as a special guest collaborator.
I had no idea. Bob taught me everything I knew, I like to say. Bob was ahead of me a year or two in the Manhattan DA's office, was a great prosecutor, is a huge, great big personality, as you know, writes wonderful books, and I love Bob.
Well, he loves you, too, because every time I talk to him, he mentions you, and his new book is coming out in August. Of course, it's another of his Butch Karp, Marlene Ciampi thriller books. It's called Without Fear or Favor, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about that. But meanwhile, every few weeks, he gives us a review of an essential book that he thinks, you know, everybody should read. And so we've been really thrilled to have him here on Joy on Paper. And
wonderful. Well, I will be plugging his new book then on my social media. Thank you for telling me about it.
Yes, you have to, because he always plugs your books because he loves you. And of course,
it's mutual.
I was really happy with the ending, you know, of Killer Look. That's your last book.
Uh-huh.
And I got to the end, you know, when one reads your books, one really doesn't want to read them too fast because you know they're going to be over with. But when I got to that ending, I said, okay, well, now this was such a blockbusting ending. I said, I know there's going to be a great book following it. And I
well,
was right.
It did something daring, don't you think? I mean, I tied up the crime in Killer Look, but then I said to the editor, look, here's how I really want to end it. Just a short chapter with something dramatic, suspenseful happening. I'm hoping my readers will come back and new readers will find it. So I ended with this dramatic murder in Killer Look. And so I opened Deadfall, this new book, an hour later.
It's so exciting. It was so exciting when I picked up the book. I mean, I knew this is where it was going to start, but I was still so anxious. Of course, it's there we have, of course, Alexandra Cooper holding the body. I mean, she's underneath the body of her longtime boss, District Attorney Paul Battaglia. And I mean, that's pretty dramatic.
It was pretty dramatic. And this one starts in the morgue where she's looking at the body, still, you know, blood on her clothes, and trying to figure out how this happened, why this happened. She's a witness to it. So the feds really want to make her a suspect. I think fun for the readers, who especially those who've read Coop before, see the tables turned on her, and she gets the treatment that she usually gives to the other guy.
Exactly.
So it was a challenge to write, but very enjoyable to make the change.
And of course, all of your readers were anxious to know where you would be this time in New York, because you always give us this wonderful treat of going to different locations in New York and weaving in seamlessly the history of the location. And last time, of course, it was this wonderful fashion show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And everybody wanted to know where this book would take us. And it really took us. I wasn't expecting it. And the entire storyline is fantastic. So we learn a lot here about the Bronx and Central Park Zoo. And
yes,
this twist of having bringing in the big game hunting theme, I thought, and conservation, of course, was really great.
Thank you. You know, when I was a prosecutor and I was there 30 years and stepped away more than a decade ago, this whole animal conservation issue had nothing to do with prosecution. But in the last 10 years, because of the predatory nature of humans, trafficking in these very valuable things like ivory elephant tusks, much to the, obviously, the slaughter of the animals, it's become an issue in crime, and it's how they're smuggled, how they're brought into this country, what becomes of them and who's profiting from it just seemed like a totally new direction, and I hope interesting one, to take the reader. It's been in the news so much. I mean, people read it in their papers, hear it on TV, listen to it on the radio. So it's a very fresh topic that I thought would be suited to a crime novel.
Well, you've woven the story into such a compelling subject, because as you said, it is now a subject that everyone's talking about. As a matter of fact, I'm just going to be interviewing Stephanie Haynes, who wrote a book called White Man's Game, and she talks, it's about Africa and about these hunters and the poachers who are buying body parts and selling body parts, and it's so horrendous. And then, of course, you take us out of New York, actually, in this book.
I do. I take you out of New York. I bring you back to the Bronx Zoo, which is one of America's great zoos. And I grew up in a very unfancy suburban town called Mount Vernon, very near the Bronx Zoo. So if we kids were good on weekends in the spring or fall, there was usually a parent who would say, come on, 15-minute ride down the parkway, we'll go to the zoo. So it was always a place I loved as a kid. Zoos have obviously changed for the better because they are, no longer lions caged up in little pens. They have acres and acres of land where they try and recreate the natural habitat. So going to the zoo with a big smile on my face that your listeners cannot see was just the most delightful part of doing research for this book.
And, of course, the part in Montana, the big gate. This is something that most people don't don't relate to. That we do have these big game hunters in the West, and they have these private clubs. And make this a very timely subject.
Thank you. As an Easterner, I really had no idea that this kind of hunting existed in America. I knew there was some of it, but had no idea. Can I tell you some breaking news about me and your neck of the woods?
Okay, absolutely.
So my husband and I fell in love with Florida, and you're the first to hear this because I think it's within scope of Joy on Paper and station. We just bought a place on Gasparilla Island, Boca Grande, off the West Coast.
Okay.
And so we will be spending many cold months in your beautiful part of the world.
Okay. Well, and you're going to spend at least 1 hour here at Joy on Paper. You're going to drive up here to the studio, and I can have you right here in the studio to talk to you. Oh, my goodness, this is going to be so thrilling.
Fascinating. Well, I accept. And a lot of Deadfall, the finishing chapters and touches of Deadfall were done in January in Boca. Just a peaceful place. My husband would leave me alone and go fishing. I'd ride my bike at the end of the day. I love that part of the world, and I love that little island. So I'll come to your studio anytime.
Oh, well, it is so beautiful here. It is a perfect place for a writer to just... It's wonderful. And as you said, your husband can go do something else because there's so much to do here. So, that's fantastic. Well, we're going to be so happy to have you here in Florida.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.
I thought you should be the first person to know the news.
Wow. That's wonderful. I have breaking news. Wow. This is fantastic.
I know. The worst expression on television, everything now is breaking news.
Yes.
So, I hate saying it, but this is really breaking news.
And this
is closed, and I wanted to tell you because you're so wonderfully enthusiastic and warm.
Well, this is breaking news that we need, because some of this breaking news on television, we don't want.
It's not so good.
Oh, boy, this interview is short because, I know when you have a release, boy, you get so busy. I, of course, will do a 15-minute intro into this into your interview, because I will tell people all about you, just for anybody who doesn't know, because I think it's so important that, readers, the more a reader knows about an author, the more they invest in their time and energy in reading that author. And so that's why I just love to talk to authors, make them really part of a reader's life. And with you, of course, you've done so many fantastic things in your life. And I'm going to be talking 15 minutes about how wonderful you are, but I do want everybody to, take some time here. And this book, It's just such a good read. All of your books are great, but this one, I just found it just moved so quickly, and I'm whoa, and I wanted to know what was going to happen. And as I said, I think it was so clever of you always to come out with this idea of weaving in the history of New York, which I think all of us love about your books.
Well, thank you. I mean, your enthusiasm is infectious. I always look forward to talking to you. I know why you have the listeners you do. And, of course, you're giving me the gift of saying all these wonderful things to your listeners. So I love writing the books. I'm one of the less introverted authors, so when the box is open and I can be on a show like this and go to book signings and stores and meet readers and answer questions, I just love it. I just love it.
Well, it's wonderful for us that you like to come on. And you know, one of the things is readers just so enjoy meeting authors, and it really helps when authors get out there and do these selfies and do these little, you know, interviews, because it makes the reader feel invested in the author. And I wanted to mention before, you know, because I don't have very long, but of course this book, everybody has to read it, Deadfall. What a perfect title, because it was, you know, once I read it, and in the first part of the book, I said, oh, that's a hint of what's coming on. Because once she says Deadfall, I thought, okay, we know there's going to be some woods here and some hunting. So it was great. And I want to mention, of course, that in addition to this wonderful book that everyone should get, I think they should go out and get your middle grade book.
Thank you.
You know, I grew up, you know, with Nancy Drew, didn't we all?
Me too.
And that you have taken on and written a book called, and the girl is named Devlin Quick, and the last book is Into the Lion's Den, and I think you've got a new book coming out. No, is
in November.
In November,
Digging for Trouble.
Okay.
In November. Yep.
And I think it's wonderful. You know, David Baldacci has done the same thing, because he also wants to reach the middle grade readers, because he knows that those middle grade readers are going to grow up and read the big books. And you know, I don't know if you've ever read any of his. You know, he writes a fantasy book.
I love David Baldacci. I've read just about everything he's written, and I admire what he does. He's a just huge-hearted, generous man.
Absolutely, he gives so much to reading organizations and groups, and so his fantasy fiction features a young girl. Also, her name is Vega Jane, and again, he is like you, trying to bring young readers, you know, into the mix, so that we get all of these excited people reading books.
That's right. Yes, and I know that he does that. And for me also, I grew up on, I had an older brother, Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, and they were mysteries in that age group, of which there are very few 8 to 12 mysteries.
Well,
and so I love that, and they were series. And so you've got a smart kid solving the crimes. She's not treated like a child. I mean, they really use their brains and their imagination, and so it's fun for me to write, and it's just a whole different world to introduce, and I hope that kids become attached to these characters and want them back the same way.
And so do I. You know, I know, unfortunately, I have to let you go, because it's at the, you know, we have to go, but you're going to be here back in November talking about the new middle grade book, and everybody has to go out and get Deadfall, okay?
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks
so much for being on today, Linda. Great. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that was fun to talk to Linda. Now, I wanted to remind everyone, yesterday was the National Book Lovers Day. And if you haven't read a book recently, then take yourself over to Amazon and either get Linda's book, it's Linda Fairstein's new book, Deadfall, or Robert K. Tannenbaum's book. And you will find that you're going to have lots of fun reading these books. And also, they are available at your local library. So pop into the library this weekend. It's a wonderful time for you to start reading and to appreciate National Readers' Day. And
Meanwhile, of course, I want to remind everyone that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper and to hear them on, you know, Audible books. I don't know if you listen to Audible books. If you haven't, take a chance and pick up an Audible book. They're available at your library, too. And it really opens your eyes to what a book, when you read a book and then you compare it to the Audible book, it's lots of fun. And I think that you will really enjoy it. And I also would like just to suggest that you, you know, sit down and write something. Perhaps you have a family memoir. And if you're looking for a really great sample of a memoir, I recommend Maria's Journey by Trish and Ray Arredondo. It's a wonderful, wonderful memoir, and it's an example of what you can do to tell the story of your family. They have preserved the story of Ray's mother and the struggles that she faced when she came to America to find a better life for her family. And I think all of you have a story out there to tell about your family. And there's so many, many resources today from the Ellis Island research and all of these different places that you can go to find out information about your family and write a memoir. And then that's about it. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. You know, find something nice to say about someone today, just randomly, just somebody you haven't said anything nice to for a long time, or pick up the phone and call somebody and say something nice to somebody. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. And he's saluting me, and I'm going to salute him back because I love to be saluted too. And just have a great weekend. Bye, everybody.